KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for joining us. The Colorado River provides water to 40 million people around the West, including New Mexico, but the historic drought gripping our region has prompted a 20% drop in river flows. Reservoirs are drying, with Lake Mead at its lowest level since it was filled in the 1930s. As scientists incorporate these changes into future projections, an article in Science magazine urges them to plan for even greater declines in the river. Co-author John Fleck says there are important lessons to learn from a hydrologist who studied the river a century ago. Fleck is director of the Water Resources Program at the University of New Mexico. He spoke with KUNM's Megan Kamrick.
In the early part of the 20th century, the science on which we base all our water management today was really being invented. And there was this amazing character named Eugene Clyde LaRue, who was a hydrologist for the U.S. Geological Survey. And so LaRue, being a good scientist and also a somewhat aggressive and abrasive intellectual, told people, look, the things that you're planning to do, you need to remember when you do them that sometimes this river has drought, sometimes this river has lower flows, and in the long run, it doesn't have as much water as you might think it is. And LaRue was ignored. It's a historical truth, but it's also a parable for our time where, you know, we now face climate change, and the climate change science is telling us some really stark truths about the decline of water here in the Western United States. And we need to pay attention to the problems we have as a result of ignoring LaRue and not repeat those mistakes.
And modelers at the Bureau of Reclamation have been incorporating climate change into their projections for river flows for some time now. But you and your co-author, Brad Udall, are questioning if they're going far enough. Why is that?
There's a tendency for the political system to put pressure on the Bureau of Reclamation modelers to make it more difficult for them to do the serious climate change scenarios, because that would then require the Bureau to go to the states, especially in the upper Colorado River Basin, and say, there is not the water for the plans that you think you want to have. But we need to have that realistic view of the risk climate change poses if we're going to make the best decisions going forward.
So there's a new round of negotiations coming up over water allocation. What are you and your co-author asking the water management community to consider?
We want to be sure that the modeling includes some reasonable but extremely dry scenarios so that the planners have a plan in place. So we know what we will do if some of the worst climate change scenarios are realized. We need to be ready for that. So we know that here in Albuquerque, there is a risk that we will not get our full amount from the San Juan Channel project.
What kind of difficult decisions lie ahead for all of us?
So this is an interesting problem, because one of the things that we have seen again and again in the Western United States and the cities and farm communities is that once we know how much water we're going to get, even if the news is bad, we've been really good at conserving water and living within our new means. If you ask people whether they want more or less water, they're always going to say more water. So the challenge is coming to agreement on lower allocations and letting all of us know what that lower allocation is going to look like, so then we can plan for it. And, you know, water conservation success in the urban West is enormously successful. Water use is going down everywhere, even as population is going up. We've seen farm communities continue to be really successful using less water, but everybody would like more. So nobody's going to sort of voluntarily raise their hand and say, yeah, we're happy to have less. And so negotiating those agreements where everybody agrees to live with less and agrees on a set of numbers or of what that might look like is really going to be the hard part. Because I'm really confident that, you know, once we come to agreement on what the allocations are going to be, we'll learn to live with them. We're really adaptable.
What should we be doing right now as citizens to prepare for a future with less water from the Colorado?
I think the first and most important thing is for communities to recognize that coping with less water is a permanent phenomenon, that we cannot expect wet times to return. And we need to cooperate with our leaders when they come to us and say, hey, there's not as much water as we thought. Y'all are going to need to cut back. Because we've been pretty good. I mean, Albuquerque is an amazingly successful water conservation story. We know how to do it, and now we know we need to do more. And that requires cooperation from the bottom up at the level of citizens. And that requires leadership on the part of our politicians who are willing to tell us these unpleasant truths and ask for our cooperation. You know, it's probably not a good idea to have a lawn anymore. You know, we've got to make those choices.
Well, John Fleck, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
To local politics now, and a plan detailing how the city of Las Cruces may spend American Rescue Plan Act funding was presented to the city council this week. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
The city of Las Cruces is seeking to use some American Rescue Plan Act funding to support public safety programs, tourism, and other community and economic development initiatives. Part of the almost $24.8 million will go toward making up for the city's pandemic-related revenue loss. City Grants Administrator Amy Johnson Basford says that while no layoffs or cuts to city services occurred, the loss was still significant.
We did find that approximately $6.9 million was lost by the city. We did experience a loss, and that loss does continue to reflect on our day-to-day work operations.
City Interim Chief Budget Officer Matthew Sines says the $6.9 million can go toward capital projects like an aquatic competition pool. Providing additional funding for current GO bond projects like the Animal Service Center was also recommended.
This is the only category in which we're allowed to use that towards the infrastructure improvements. And also this is directly related to the pandemic with cost increase for labor and materials.
$2 million is being proposed to support the city's public health response. This will include the addition of two surveillance trailers, doubling the current amount the police department has on hand. Las Cruces Police Chief Miguel Dominguez detailed how the trailers can deter commercial burglaries.
It's all real time. So wherever we're seeing spikes in crime, for the pandemic specifically, we were seeing a lot of commercial burglaries. People were breaking in through the backs or the rear entrances and windows of certain businesses. So we were able to deploy these trailers and surveil them where officers weren't necessarily having to go by, but we were able to kind of see them through a mobile app.
Councilor Joanna Bencomo says that while she understands the extra surveillance needed during the pandemic, she's concerned about over-policing.
Yeah, I can definitely see how this probably could have came more in handy in the middle of the public health orders, given that, you know, businesses were closed temporarily. Now that, you know, those orders are lifted, now that we're getting a little bit more back to normal, I'm nervous about the potential of over-policing in certain neighborhoods.
One of LCPD's current surveillance trailers has already been placed in downtown Las Cruces, something Councilor Cassandra Gondra voiced support of. She says she welcomes the addition of more trailers.
I'm really glad that the smart technology with the surveillance trailers are part of this. I think it's an important piece of technology. I do know that having it in the downtown, we've deterred quite a bit of crime, property crime, break-ins.
$1 million is currently slated to go toward Visit Las Cruces with the hope of revitalizing the tourism industry post-pandemic. $300,000 of that is budgeted for website, visual assets, and social media, something Councilor Gabe Vasquez questioned.
If someone asked me, give them $300,000 for a new website, visual assets, and social media, I would be like, wow, it's a crazy astronomical number to me, the cost on that. So I'm wondering if you could break down that cost a little bit more, because that's a really, really high price.
Paul Dahlgren, the media publications manager for Visit Las Cruces, says funding would be spread out over several years. Targeted areas include a new website, a cost Dahlgren estimated could be as high as $50,000. He also noted some of the funding will be used to purchase artwork for public spaces.
About $10,000 for just actually getting artwork at the convention center, because some of those spaces are quite large and we'd want to do something that would be durable, and same for the airport.
Vasquez also suggested Visit Las Cruces promote the cannabis industry, pointing to cannabis tours in Colorado that have become a tourist attraction.
I think we need to be promoting the cannabis industry here in Las Cruces. I think this is going to be the single largest source of tourism for Las Cruces, and I'd hate to see us miss out on an opportunity to do this.
More information on the spending plan will be presented to the council August 9th. The work session is slated to cover community and economic development initiatives. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
A guaranteed basic income program is being discussed in Las Cruces. Some thoughts from commentator Walt Rubel.
There are no free lunches. If you don't work, you don't eat. Everybody has to pitch in and carry their weight. These aphorisms from my youth passed on by my parents and others from their generation who survived the Great Depression during their childhood, pop into my mind each time I hear about a new government plan to give people free money. Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang proposed a plan in which all citizens of working age, regardless of their income, would get $1,000 checks each month from the federal government. Las Cruces City Council member Johanna Bencomo has now proposed a new city program in which low-income residents would receive a guaranteed basic income through direct payments from the city government. She wants to start with a small group of residents in a pilot program first. Details are still being worked out, but Bencomo said she'd like to have those selected be paid at least $500 a month, which they could then spend any way they wanted. She said that similar programs elsewhere have led to improved health outcomes and employment opportunities for participants. And I don't doubt that a pilot program here would have the same result, assuming we pick the right people for the program. Bencomo's plan is to take the money from existing funds. That will work for now, but the program will need a recurring funding source to be sustainable. But beyond the question of if we can is the much larger question of if we should. More specifically, if we give people money for not working, will that reduce the incentive to work? And if that happens, what will that mean for our nation's productivity? The $600 a month boost to unemployment benefits made through the Federal CARES Act has led to millions of workers delaying their return to the workplace, while employers desperate to get up and running again after the pandemic are scrambling to find help. I understand the argument for a guaranteed basic income. The federal minimum wage has been frozen at $7.25 an hour since 2009. Union membership has been decimated by right-to-work laws, with barely 10% of the workforce now enjoying representation. As a result, the wealth gap in the United States has increased to indefensible levels. I understand that millions of people need help, and I'm sparing my tears for employers who have steadfastly opposed any increase to the minimum wage and are now having a hard time finding workers. I fully support increased spending for child care services, job training, rental assistance, affordable housing, and emergency food programs. But money for nothing? Free checks in the mail each month just for being? Still having a hard time with that one. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. With the Virgin Galactic launch on Sunday, the focus was on New Mexico and Spaceport America. But another space company is making much larger investments in Texas. SpaceX founder Elon Musk announced his company would break ground on a second factory for its Raptor engines. And SpaceX continues to expand its own launch site in the state. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav has more.
The commercial space operator says the McGregor, Texas location will ramp up to producing 2 to 4 engines a day. Musk said they would produce 800 to 1,000 engines a year. The chief aim, he said, was creating a fleet to operate a base on Mars in 30 years. While SpaceX adds to its facilities in McGregor, it continues to expand and build at its Boca Chica Beach launch site. The launch site, nicknamed Starbase, is set to test the company's enormous Super Heavy booster this month. It would be a first in Texas. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
And a footnote to this story this week, New Mexico Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham said that she is trying to convince Virgin Galactic to move some manufacturing operations to New Mexico. The University of North Carolina tracks the loss of newspapers across the country. Its most recent report from last year looked at the industry's decline from 2004 through 2019. During that period, more than 2,000 newspapers were lost, and there was a 44% drop in circulation overall. I talked about the implications of this with Dr. Lindsay Green-Barber and Hannah Stonebreaker. They are from Impact Architects, which studied the news landscape in New Mexico and many other places across the country for the Knight Foundation.
You know, I think it's important to state at the outset that newspapers are just one form of news and information, but surely the loss of local reporting and locally based reporters is a huge problem for the U.S. right now. We've seen, as all of your viewers know, less community cohesion and greater polarization across the country at the same time that we've seen these declines in local newspapers. And there's significant research that suggests that local reporting is really critical for bridging these gaps across different sectors of the community and contributing to a shared sense of community and of identity. And it's worth noting that newspapers in particular have a complicated history in the US, and they've often contributed to racist and patriarchal systems and communities. And there's much work to be done, and that is being done by local news organizations to help rectify some of those relationships.
Such important issues. Hannah, tell me about your research. You looked at a diverse mix of places across the country.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us and for highlighting this work. The work was supported by the Knight Foundation, as you mentioned, Democracy Fund, and Google News Initiative. And we looked at case studies across 9 different communities in the United States. And the idea was to apply a framework to a real variety of places. You know, we looked at some municipalities, some counties, and then we looked at New Mexico as a state, which is a really interesting one to look at. And as your viewers know, there's lots of unique things about New Mexico that you wouldn't find in other local news environments.
What stood out most to you about New Mexico?
Yeah, I mean, as it's an incredibly diverse and relatively diffuse state, there aren't that many dense centers of population, and that really impacts the type of local news that you see. 4 different counties are news deserts, meaning they don't have a single local newspaper. And that's about 125,000 people who don't have any concentrated newspaper just committed to their community. So there's a huge need for more local news, but there's also a huge need for greater diversity. New Mexico is a highly diverse place. There are so many different communities and not a lot of news catering to specific information needs in those communities. Radio stations are the most popular in New Mexico and the most present. It's unsurprising given just the geographic vastness of New Mexico and that radio is kind of easiest to disperse. There's also a need for more philanthropic funding. There's a lot of philanthropy going into news right now, but in a place like New Mexico, on a per capita basis, there isn't as much as there should be in order to really support the state. There are some really great institutions doing amazing work, though. The New Mexico Local News Fund is specifically centered around strengthening local news in New Mexico. But there are a lot of challenges and a lot of uphill battles in order to strengthen the news enough to provide everyone with the information they need and they want.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll have more time later to talk about philanthropy. The New Mexico Local News Fund, KRWG Public Media, I should say, has been a beneficiary of that because we participated in a collaboration funded by the Local News Fund to improve reporting on the state legislative session. Speaking of money, Lindsay, your work cites a report by the nonprofit New Mexico First, and it notes a problem here that is also evident in many other places around the country, and that's a lack of qualified journalists due to low pay.
Yeah, it's a huge problem, not only in New Mexico, as you said, and there are many reasons for this, and we could spend, you know, way longer than 20 minutes talking about all of the structural issues that are a factor here. But low pay is one of them, and that has to do with just the challenges around sustainability in news and information in general, and the fact that there is no one business model that can support news and information, and it's really important in any ecosystem to have a diversity of business models. We can talk more about that perhaps.
But yeah, it's so important to mention because, of course, newspapers, part of this incredible decline that I mentioned at the top of this conversation, is that they used to receive so much more revenue from advertising. And with with certainly getting subscriptions to online content, that's worked really well for the New York Times or the Washington Post, but not so well for many smaller newspapers that are simply seeing a decline in subscription revenue, and then at the same time a massive decline in advertising. The New Mexico First report also found a growing amount of marketing content masquerading as news. And Lindsay, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about that because it's something that's alarming and some would argue may further hurt news organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to point back to one thing that you mentioned also about subscription rates. And one of the challenges here is that in some cases, subscription rates for local publications may have declined somewhat. And in the past year, actually, due to many things, the pandemic, a need for local news and information, elections that were, you know, requiring a lot of information and coverage, many local publications that are still around actually saw their subscriptions increasing. The challenge is that the incentive structure for these businesses, as they have been acquired by large corporations, by hedge funds that have larger demands and needs for profit margins, means that even if you have more subscriptions and even if you're making more revenue than you did the year before, the kind of powers that be still are requiring greater margins. And so you still end up with layoffs. And so you get this kind of vicious cycle happening. So just wanted to point out that, you know, and again, this is not just a plug for public media, but when you are thinking about ownership structure for, you know, if you are subscribing or you're becoming a member, to think about that ownership and what the incentives are. And, you know, paying for membership to public media, those resources then get reinvested into the organization in a way that they may not for a legacy commercially owned newspaper.
Sure.
So that's one thing. But then the question about, you know, content that's masquerading as news or sponsored content, this is a symptom, again, of a misalignment between the financial incentive structures of news and the public service mission that drives news organizations or the news organizations are aiming to play. And as news organizations are struggling to find pathways to financial sustainability, sponsored content, unfortunately, has emerged as one of the ways that organizations are able to find revenue. And I think the jury is still out to some extent about how does different kind of labeling help indicate to an audience person, you know, this is essentially advertising versus this is a news story. And, you know, I think we're seeing that it's eroding trust, but we don't have a definitive answer there yet.
Yeah.
My empathy is with those organizations that are struggling to find a way to just generate revenue.
Yeah, and you see this even on national websites like USA Today, their website, where it'll say sponsored content. And it looks like there's a headline and a photo. It looks like it's a news story, but in fact, it's just marketing. And I get the sense that this is increasing dramatically. I get emails every day from folks who want to do sponsored content on our website, something we of course, do not do. Speaking of this issue, Hannah, New Mexico First says there is a need for better media literacy. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think media literacy is a huge part of the puzzle. You know, you have to look for that sponsored content, you know, piece when you're looking at different news articles that look like news articles but might not be. But there's also a huge responsibility here of the news organizations themselves. They can do a lot more work in ensuring that their content is presented in a way that's clear to the audience what it is, where it's coming from, why they should trust them. You know, a huge number of people don't know the difference between an opinion piece and a journalistic investigative reporting piece because you flip through a newspaper and they're presented pretty similarly, layouts the same. And so, you know, there are community-based journalism organizations that are really trying hard to reach people in innovative ways that can help strengthen media literacy. Organizations trying SMS messaging, broadcast radio, which we know in New Mexico has been really successful.
Yeah.
In-person events has grown to really strengthen the relationship between journalists and their community, which can help so much with media literacy.
And, you know, media literacy, of course, Hannah, important for another reason. Beyond the issue of marketing content making its way into the news, of course, there's also the issue of lots of false information online and folks going to that information thinking it's a credible news source when it's not. What can be done, in your view, to combat this kind of thing in addition to media literacy training?
Yeah, it's a great question, and in some ways it's one of the huge questions of the day, and it has a lot to do with our technology companies just as much as it has to do with our news organizations. You know, structurally, there needs to be some regulation of platforms where misinformation from untrustworthy news sites circulate. But there also needs to be enforcement of current regulations that exist. But because we've never had technology or networks happening in this scale before, they've never been enforced. A lot of it then also has to do with strengthening that trust and relationship between news organizations and the people that they're aiming to serve. You know, you build that trust, people see the reporters in the news organization, they see that they're there for the community, and it makes it easier to notice those are trustworthy sources that have a process and ethical guidelines versus a misinformation story that's spreading like wildfire because it's, you know, super interesting were it real, but it's often not.
Yeah, absolutely. Lindsay, in the report, you cite data showing that online sources have eclipsed every other source for news. Yet in states like New Mexico, with large rural populations, lots of people don't even have high-speed internet access, something we often refer to as the digital divide. Tell me your thoughts about the implications of this dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, you almost can't overstate what a problem this is in the country right now. And if we learned anything in the past year about the digital divide and the effect that that has on student learners and their ability to access, you know, digital classrooms during a pandemic, I mean, really just saw this divide play out in so many really like tangible sort of ways. And, you know, I think there's a lot of hope right now where if we're going to start treating actual access and digital infrastructure as just that, as a public service and part of our national infrastructure, I think that is really important and shouldn't be divorced from the conversations we're having about access to news and information also as a public service or a public good. And beyond that, you know, one of the reasons that digital startups or news startups so often go digital is it's the least expensive way to put information out there. And you see a lot of innovation around, you know, digital podcasting, which again is a great way to get information into, for example, predominantly Spanish-speaking communities where the way information is consumed and most trusted is through the radio historically. But what does that mean if you don't actually have access or if you don't have 5G even to be able to download it, even if you can't plug in your laptop or your computer? So, you know, getting that infrastructure is critically important. And in the interim, thinking as a news organization about what the efforts are, what does it look like to reach communities in a place like New Mexico, where so many folks are rural or living in rural areas, what does it look like to think about broadcast radio or partnerships? And you mentioned, you know, collaboration earlier. And so how can news organizations collaborate to take advantage of that broadcast infrastructure that somewhere like KRWG has, but in order to get reporting that maybe a digital first investigative news organization is really doing the work for and getting out there. And so, you know, I think those are some of the ways that an ecosystem can come together and you can really think about where collaborative reporting and news can help to ensure that the information is reaching diverse sectors of the community.
Sure. And I want to be able to wrap up our conversation with hope. So, Lindsay, I want to give you a chance to talk about one of the hopeful signs is, and that is the growth in philanthropy in supporting news coverage nationwide.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a rapid increase. I think I just saw Media Impact Funders, an organization that kind of convenes philanthropy that supports news and information, came out with a report today that it's, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars from local local foundations, community and place-based foundations that have gone into news and information in the past 5 years or so. And so when you're thinking about this sector, it is just growing. There are more resources. There are more foundations that are interested in things like education or like the environment that are recognizing, wow, if you don't have a local reporter who can cover the environment, like, you're missing a big part of the story, right? Then people don't even know what's happening locally. Same goes for education. If you don't have a local reporter covering the school board, how are folks going to know what's happening there? And so you've got new players coming into the space. And then I think the challenge, though, is to recognize, or for some of these philanthropic entities to recognize, what is the value of journalism as a nonpartisan, independent entity that can go out and do high quality reporting with professional norms and ethics, and, you know, not to be a mouthpiece or a think tank, or, you know, there's no agenda in the reporting. And so it's not to say that this is the silver bullet and this will solve all the problems. There are still challenges, and philanthropy is playing a massive role in ensuring that local communities have access to news and information right now.
Yes, absolutely. Hannah, you cite two KRWG partners that benefit from donations, not just from major foundations, et cetera, but from individuals too. New Mexico In-Depth and Searchlight New Mexico.
Both are really great organizations doing really important work in a state where the legacy news organizations have been declining, if not have already closed. As we spoke about before, there's four counties with no local news. The vast majority of counties only have one local news source. So both organizations are, you know, digital first, nonpartisan, nonprofit, and they're focused on accountability journalism, on investigative work, on looking at the state and where are the stories that aren't being told that are incredibly important for people to understand. You know, they also are looking at capacity building. How do you bring in the next generation of journalists in a way that's actually representative of the people of New Mexico and ensure that all communities have journalists who understand their communities and can tell their stories accurately?
And Hannah, are you seeing this around the country? I mean, there have been some really high profile examples of digital outlets like this that are nonprofit, like the Texas Tribune. Are there others, and have you seen more communities getting digital outlets like this?
For sure. There have been so many communities where these types of new, you know, startup nonprofits, digital first, are coming into being. Lindsay and I are based in San Francisco and in the East Bay. City Side, which now supports Berkeley Side and Oakland Side, are doing really amazing work in looking at mission-oriented nonprofit news that serves communities that have had a lot of misperceptions about them in more traditional media. So it's really important, and they're both, you know, evidence of growing trends in both nonprofit news and digital first. And they're trying to fill this gap. But, you know, as we've spoken about before, the money isn't there how it used to be in an advertising model. So these organizations are doing incredible work. They're filling the gap where legacy news isn't anymore, but they're still on, you know, a pretty shoestring budget, and we need to do all we can to support them and make sure that they're as aligned with their communities as possible.
Hannah and Lindsay, we've started the conversation, a great one and a very important topic for not only the news media, but for democracy. It is just really an important issue, and we appreciate you starting the conversation on this in our community. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
And if you missed any of that conversation, you can watch it tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV, or right now in the local TV section. Look for Newsmakers there, and you'll find the full episode, which also includes a video report on the Spaceport America launch of Virgin Galactic's Unity spacecraft. Great job on that from Madison Staten. KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. Thank you so much for being with us. A lot of health news this week, and we have it all for you. About 1.5 million Texans are now getting health insurance through healthcare.gov. It's one of the biggest enrollment numbers Texas has seen in years. And as KUT's Ashley Lopez reports, enrollment is still open nationwide because of the pandemic.
The Biden administration created a special enrollment period for the online health insurance marketplace that ends in mid-August. Combined with an uptick in signups during the regular enrollment period last winter, Stacey Pogue with the policy think tank Every Texan says Texas now has a lot more people signed up for these health plans than in the past several years.
Texas saw the largest increase in enrollment compared to any other state. Our enrollment year over year increased about 15 or 16%. So there's no question that during COVID, during the pandemic, going into 2021, there was a huge demand.
Plans on healthcare.gov are also more affordable than they have ever been because of more funding for subsidies from Congress. Pogue says about half of Texans who have bought plans recently are paying $10 or less a month for their health plans. And almost everyone qualifies for some level of financial help to pay for their insurance.
I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Enrollment ends August 15th, so if you do not have health insurance, it's time to move on that. We have more on this now. The Affordable Care Act allows states to expand Medicaid coverage, but 12 states, including Texas, have not done so. Now, Democrats in Congress have an idea to go around those state leaders and allow local governments to expand Medicaid themselves. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav has that.
Texas has more than 5.2 million people without health insurance. At more than 18% uninsured, it's double the national average. And people without coverage are less likely to get screened for disease or have an annual checkup, delaying care until it's sometimes too late, says Tommy Austin, chief nurse executive for San Antonio's University Health System.
Cancers that have not been diagnosed, chronic illnesses such as diabetes and other illnesses that you might see someone who has gangrene in their limbs because they have not done the proper care.
Despite polls regularly showing expanding Medicaid is popular in Texas, that support doesn't extend to the state's Republican leadership. For a decade, GOP leaders have fought the Affordable Care Act and its Medicaid expansion. Former Texas Governor Rick Perry called Medicaid expansion, quote, fiscal coercion. He didn't trust the federal government to pay what it said it would. Here he is in a 2013 speech saying it could leave Texas holding the bag.
Nothing stops Washington from changing the rules down the road and increasing the state share, which in the case of Texas will be up to more than $18 billion over 10 years.
A decade later, states pay just 10% of the expanded coverage. But leaders of the Texas GOP haven't budged in their opposition.
Well, thank you all very much for being here.
So last month, Democratic members of Congress, led by Texas's Lloyd Doggett, announced legislation to offer Medicaid expansion dollars directly to cities, counties, and hospital districts.
Congress needs to help us overcome state Republican obstruction and provide an alternative pathway to access health care for about 6 million Americans who've been denied access to Medicaid.
The bill has more than 40 co-sponsors in the House, but faces an uphill battle. Congressional Dems hope it will be included in a reconciliation bill, avoiding a filibuster in the Senate. Under the plan, local governments could contract directly with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. San Antonio Mayor Ron Nuremberg knows the process could be cumbersome, but he says he would take the funds, pointing out Texas residents have been paying for benefits they've yet to receive.
Absolutely. It's already money we are simply sending to other places in the country that should be coming home to do what it's intended to do, and that is provide access to public health.
Doggett's office predicts they can enroll about half of the state's eligible population just from Texas's major cities. The other half live in rural Texas.
The demographics of rural Texas are very challenging. We say older, poorer, sicker.
And John Henderson with the Texas Organization of Rural and Community Hospitals says even though Texas leads the nation in rural hospital closures, because of politics, small conservative counties wouldn't take the money.
Even if it were to pass, I'm not aware of a rural county that would take the help in Texas.
So while Doggett's bill could give more than a million Texans health care, it would likely bring the patchwork of coverage and partisan battles over who gets it to the local level. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
Millions of families in the region care for adult relatives in the home. Nearly 3.5 million in Texas alone. A new study from the AARP finds that families spend a lot of their own money when they're caring for an aging loved one, about $7,000 a year on average. KERA's Christopher Connolly has more.
Caring for those aging loved ones can be rewarding, but also exhausting. Most caregivers also work outside of the home, according to the study, and a third spend more than 20 hours a week providing unpaid care, taking a parent to doctor's appointments, making sure an aunt's house gets cleaned, even doing medical tasks for a spouse. Amanda Fredrickson is with the AARP.
What this research found is that family caregivers are actually spending a good bit of money out of their own pockets to care for their loved ones.
On average, caregivers spend a quarter of their income on caregiving. For Black and Latino families, the financial strain is even greater. More than a third of income for Black caregivers and almost half of income for Latino caregivers. And there's a generational component, too.
Gen X caregivers spend the most money, over $8,000 on average. And Gen Z and millennial caregivers are actually feeling the greatest financial strain. So they're spending a bigger share of their household income.
The AARP is advocating for federal legislation that would create a tax credit, which would help most caregivers. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
Well, some say issues like caregiving would get a lot more attention if we had more women elected to public office. But women often face a money crunch on the road to being elected. The New Mexico News Connection's Roz Brown reports.
Women have voted at higher rates than men in every presidential election since 1984. But a new study shows when they run for a statewide executive office, money is harder to come by. Report co-author Kira Sanbon-Matsu with the Center for American Women in Politics says women running in statewide executive races, excluding governor and lieutenant governor, face greater campaign finance challenges than men. She says from both a donor and recipient perspective, there are significant discrepancies between men and women.
We hear so much about how well women are doing as voters. Women have outvoted men for many years. I don't know that people realize that women are not at the same rate as givers, as men.
Sanbon-Matsu says part of the lack of campaign contributions may be that some statewide elections are below the radar for women, with only 31% of women holding statewide executive office nationwide. She adds it's likely that because women often don't earn as much as men, they can't afford to contribute more. New Mexico's Deb Haaland, now the U.S. Interior Secretary, was one of the first two Native American women elected to Congress in 2018. Sanbon-Matsu says it's important to recognize firsts for women and also acknowledge how much harder the road might have been for them.
Certainly with Haaland in power, certainly with Vice President Kamala Harris, this is a new landscape for women in politics. But we're not at parity.
Sanbon-Matsu says women remain underrepresented as office holders for such positions as attorneys general, state treasurers, and secretaries of state. And it's especially true of Asian American, Black, Latina, and Native American women.
Women of color, compared to white women, wield fewer personal resources, and they are less likely as candidates to enter these statewide races. So we really need to marshal support for them if we're going to see those numbers go up.
She adds women are less likely to self-fund their campaigns and more likely to fundraise in small dollar amounts, meaning they may face additional burdens in the fundraising process. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
The StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces in March of last year, and through this month, we are presenting portions of those interviews. Today, Frances Williams talks about her life as a military wife married to a World War II veteran. She was interviewed by her friend, Monica Kimball.
I want to tell you how I met my husband. Very interesting. I'm a girl from Brooklyn, New York. It was World War II, and we used to meet at the Astor Hotel. Well, I had a date, and he stood me up. But two sailors came along, and they were both from the South. I'd never heard a Southern accent. And so they were trying to pick me up. And they followed me, and I told a cop, these guys are bothering me. And he said, lady, there's a war going on. Take them in and get them sobered up. And that's how I met my husband. I should also tell you, at the time, I was 13 years old. I don't usually tell people that. So
it's on record now.
Well, that's why I'm such a young great-grandmother. Anyway, so after that, I started seeing my husband, who was Oswald L. Williams, and he was a Navy man. I ran away from home to marry him, and I was 16 years old. He took off and went back to sea, and he had just come back from the North African theater. After that, he went to England. He was on D-Day, and he drove the LSG from England to the beaches of Normandy, dropped off the troops, and then took the wounded and the dead back to England. And he did that for several months. And I was working then for the Air Force. And my mother-in-law was helping me, you know, take care of the children. We lived with her and mm-hmm. so forth.
Oswald was in the Navy for 24 years, right?
24 years.
Out of those years, how many years do you think you've actually spent together?
Not a lot.
Not a lot. No. In that time.
One of the problems when you have separations, there's a great deal of domestic violence. There's a great deal of divorce. And of course, when your husband is at sea for 9 months or a year and they're pulling into ports, there was no question in my mind that...
What they are and are consisted of?
Yes. So after that, when he went back, then he went back to sea and I came back to Las Cruces. And I vowed I would never, ever leave again. I wrote a poem. I called it The Warrior's Wife, a Tribute. I have walked the path of warriors, though I am not a warrior. I have felt the pain of warriors, though I have not been wounded. I have cried the tears of warriors, though I have not held a fallen comrade who died during battle. I have heard the warrior's words, honor, loyalty, service, love of country and faith, and I embrace them. I have felt the warrior's loneliness, for I have suffered those desperate, lonely hours too. I have felt the warrior's fear and apprehension. My fear is not knowing what happened to my warrior. I have felt the grief of the warrior's family, never to return to the embrace of loved ones who waited patiently for them. I have walked the empty path where my warrior walked, but will walk no more. Fear of battle, fear of loss, waiting, wanting, not knowing, the joy of reunion and return. The path of the warriors leaves footsteps leading in many directions. The courage is the hallmark of the warrior, and for those he left behind to rejoice and grieve, joy and sorrow. The brand of the warrior on the living touched by their sacrifices. How to repay their gifts to us of liberty and freedom, only with peace.
Oh, that's splendid. I think it's just a most beautiful tribute, and I thank you so much, my friend.
Well, thank you for listening. I appreciate it.
To hear the full interview with Francis Williams and other StoryCorps interviews, look for StoryCorps under the radio section at krwg.org. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, accepting admission in their 3 sanitized homes. More at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. Well, we started this program with news about the effects of the dramatic drought and how climate change may be part of that in terms of the loss of water on the Colorado River and how that affects much of the West. Many, of course, are alarmed about the effects of climate change. Some thoughts now from commentator Peter Goodman.
3 recent events created a unique snapshot of how badly we're failing to keep global warming from extinguishing species and making our grandkids' lives nasty, brutish, and short. Record high temperatures hit unusual places. Leaks indicate the next UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment will warn even more urgently that we are nearly out of time. And top Exxon lobbyists, thinking they were being interviewed for cushier jobs, bragged on video that they had misled the public about climate. Portland, Oregon's all-time high jumped from 107 to 116. Nearly 100 people died. In Seattle, record temperatures reaching 108 buckled roads and made concrete crumble. The Arctic Circle region, which had recorded its first 100-degree day last year, hit 118. There's no certainty that global warming causes any specific weather event, but the new IPCC assessment is clear. Global warming is here, posing unprecedented threats. Very soon, life-changing deterioration will be inevitable. Nothing we can do. Furthermore, events compound each other. Sea ice reflects solar rays back up into the sky, but we're losing sea ice way faster than expected, so that the Earth retains more and more of that warmth. That speeds up melting of the permafrost in Canada and Siberia, which in turn releases more carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide, compounding the warming and further accelerating loss of sea ice. The assessment also claims that fast action could still avoid the worst economic and ecological impacts. But even if such action could work, we won't take it. Consider the sting on Exxon lobbyists, who bragged that Exxon has lied for years about climate. Exxon and others spend big bucks befriending politicians and have given huge amounts to advocacy groups, such as the Competitive Enterprise Institute, Frontiers of Freedom, the Heartland Institute, and the Heritage Foundation, to deny climate science and promote use of fossil fuels. Many folks listen and deny reality or support a carbon tax. The lobbyists admitted that Exxon feigns support for a carbon tax because Exxon knows there's no chance one will ever be enacted. One lobbyist said he talks daily to Joe Manchin and took credit for sowing doubt on the science behind climate change and for watering down legislation. He added, quote, "But there's nothing illegal about that. You know, we were looking out for our investments," unquote. This also is no surprise, but it illustrates why any thoughtful person who's been reading about scientific doubt should recheck his or her sources. Skepticism is healthy. Disinformation is not. Life as we know it is in imminent danger, and many national leaders refuse to act. Neither business as usual nor politics as usual is acceptable. The danger involves us all and our descendants. Sounds like we the people need to rise up and take some form of strong, unified, but nonviolent action. I just wish I knew what the hell that'd be.
Peter Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. That's KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for joining us. If you ever miss the program, you'll find it anytime in the local radio section at krwg.org. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekends.